This summer, Batman Nightcast returns.
Because we, just like Lex Luthor, will not abide Superman dominating the pop culture conversation.
That's not true at all. We love Batman and Superman. That's why the first five episodes of the new Nightcast will spotlight both of them together as friends.
It kicks off in June with the weekly release of new episodes covering the first five issues of Mark Waid and Dan Mora's modern Batman Superman World's Finest.
All leading up to the new Superman movie. Holy Bat Synergy!
And after that, we'll revisit those beloved Max Allen Collins issues.
Maybe you are Lex Luthor.
Batman Nightcast.
Part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Hey Kids Comics!
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to Hey Kids Comics 2, which today takes a little divergence.
It's not necessarily divergence. We fall into a tad little more serious than we usually are.
Yeah.
But that's why we have this trusty sound effect that goes at the push of a button or at the push of that button.
So basically you want to be like Freebie and the... No, it's not Freebie and the Bean.
Freebie
and the Bean's a film. Right. What's the... breakfast duo that they take the piss out of on Family Guy.
I know
those guys. Yeah. You know what I mean. So if we're getting too serious, we'll press the fart button.
We'll press the fart button, and then there's another one that just goes...
just irritating screeching at all times. Yeah, because today we are covering Shigeru Mizuki. Did I say that correctly?
Shigeru Mizuki, yeah.
Thank you very much. Epic. Onwards towards our noble death.
Which is hard to talk about without getting a little serious in places.
Yeah, so if you were a bit, you know, with Super and Smashes the Clan.
Yeah. I was quite conscious that we've gone from semi-political to very political. But
this one's not. We'll get into it. I don't think this is political. Believe it or not.
Right, okay.
There's a discussion here. Yeah, I think he largely eschews politics.
Yeah.
And that's not what this is about.
No.
Which I found very interesting in light of our conversation about Superman Smashes the Clan, that not talking about something is a political decision.
Yeah.
So when he's created this piece of art, he has made a decision to not talk about the politics of the war.
Yes.
Inherently.
Yeah.
What he's talking about is something completely different.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that later. Because
that was
genuinely, I'm not shooting our load before we start. I genuinely loved this.
Right, okay.
I really did. I tore through this while you were at Glastonbury weekend.
Yeah.
Because I'm sat there and I put it down. And you know when you finish a good book and you go, and your mum sat there going, you've read that already. Because she's looking at the thickness of it.
Yeah.
Now, it's a manga, so there's pages upon pages of no dialogue.
Well,
all right, yeah. Now we are, she's
we
now.
Are.
Okay. Before we get to the serious stuff, let's do the fart gags.
We'll do the fart gags.
So, as usual, we've got a few emails. Rob McCarthy emailed in about Ultimate Spider-Man, which we covered ages ago.
Mm-hmm.
And because of how we've recorded everything out of order, and when we could get together and all that stuff, this fell through the cracks. So Rob's thoughts on Ultimate Spider-Man 1, didn't read 2000. Rob loved continuity. Bah. Was that because he didn't like that they threw all the continuity out for Ultimate? But the thing with Ultimate Spider-Man, six issues down the line, it has continuity.
Yeah.
That's the problem with serialised fiction.
It becomes the very thing it swore to destroy. Yeah,
it became the very thing. But that's we can slag off Bendis and some of his stuff that wasn't for me, and I think he stuck around at Marvel a little bit too long, and some of his runs had a sameness to them. But at the same time, what he did with Ultimate Spider-Man, we shouldn't be taking anything away from that. That was an accomplishment.
Yeah.
To do as much of that as he did and to reinvent that character as he did. And then to take Peter Parker off the table and reinvent it again, but with Miles Morales, that was important to a lot of people.
Mm.
A lot of kids really glommed onto Miles Morales, a being of mixed race.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't really... For his accomplishments, we should acknowledge what he accomplished.
Yeah, there's a lot to criticise.
But at the same time, acknowledge that a lot of his stuff just didn't jibe with me.
Yeah.
For me, he read his Ultimate Spider-Man and I read his Daredevil, and that's pretty much all I needed from him.
Mm.
I didn't need anything else. That was good enough for me. I can read those two runs and move on.
Yeah.
And just let him do it. Because you loved his Avengers run.
I enjoyed it when I read it, yeah. It's one of those things that I'm quite happy to never reread. I enjoyed it.
The time.
Yeah.
But then you've got Miles Morales is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And fair play to him for doing that. And the amount of people that's realised. And just the YouTubers that upsets. Fair play for that.
There's an argument there, isn't there, that Miles Morales is what became after Bendis, but he set the blueprint to a degree.
Yeah, because I've said I've got the omnibus of Miles Morales' first appearances, and everything that's in that omnibus is in Into the Spider-Verse, the movie.
Yeah.
But they do it better.
Yeah.
They actually make him feel real and not just a knockoff of Peter Parker. But then you've got the Riri Williams stuff. That impacted on people. She's got her own show. So there's a level of import there as well that, you know, maybe we're a bit snotty about when we're only looking at it through our filtered lenses.
It's easy to be snotty about Bendis.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes we should take the high road with Bendis. Sometimes I think that we don't look at his accomplishments. We look purely at the stuff that we thought was a bit whiffy and were snotty about it. But when you take the 100-mile view, he did accomplish quite a lot, and he should be recognised for that. And that some of the things that, like Miles Morales, he's still around.
Yeah.
And in some places, he eclipses Peter in popularity.
Yeah.
So that's, and obviously it's appealing to a demographic that was previously underserved. So, you know, give the guy credit for stuff like that. Number two, Andy, if I'd read Craven shagging Betty Brant, I'd have hated it. Don't hate it now. The poor girl's only human. I know, but it's a conflict of interest. She's supposed to be a reporter. You're not supposed to be sleeping with the people you report on, Lois. Just pointing that out, that's all. So that's Rob. Thank you. We finally got to it.
Yeah.
Facebook... I got a message from Rob Kelly. Remember when we did the Treasury Edition?
Yes, yeah.
And I mentioned that Rob did treasuryeditions.com for the longest time, and then he turned that into Treasury Cast.
Okay,
which ended after 100 episodes, but he's still very, very good. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on a few. It's genuinely one of my favourite podcasts.
Right.
And I fair play to him for ending it.
Yeah.
Rather than pod fading.
Right.
I like people that do that.
It's when better...
it comes to an end. Better to burn out than to fade away.
Than to pod fade.
Yeah, that's exactly
now this is pod fading.
Kurgan and Anakin Skywalker had it exactly right. And typically, he ended the show just before we got new treasuries. But anyway, but Rob said, DC started numbering their treasuries with C20, Rudolph, and then just kept numbering. I don't know what the C means. And given US postal regulations, my assumption is that DC had a comic they cancelled after 19 issues and then retired it as limited collector's edition to keep from having to buy a new permit or whatever. That's clever.
Right.
Yeah. Because didn't Stan Lee do that all the time?
He did
keep
it, right?
The name and number of a book.
Right.
So The Incredible Hulk... once it stopped being Tales of Suspense, I think it was,
and
became the Hulk at issue 100, but it kept that numbering.
Right.
And didn't he do the same with Captain America and Iron Man?
Okay.
He kept the numbering of Tales of Suspense, something like that.
So that's where today's legacy numbers kind of started.
Yeah, so there was no issue one of Iron Man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or did Iron Man get an issue one and Cap took over the numbering of Tales of Suspense? It was something like that, and I can't be bothered looking it up. The rule was, Rob continues, the title change was supposed to be similar, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes to Legion of Superheroes, stuff like that, to at least pretend it was the same magazine. But obviously, comics companies got away with completely changing things, like when All-Star Comics went to All-Star Western. Almost all the classic EC horror titles were formerly romance comics,
right,
but kept that number in. So they didn't have to file a new patent or whatever. So there, that doesn't explain the random numbering of the C, whatever, but at least it gave us a better idea. Okay, so why were they called this?
Yeah.
Thank you, Rob. That made perfect sense.
So that'll be why you have things like Batman and the Outsiders.
Yes.
The Outsiders.
Yeah.
And what's the other one? The old new fun then became more fun?
Something
or the other
like
way around?
That. Yeah. But it kept that numbering system.
Yeah.
And so it must be completely different nowadays for them to keep renumbering at number one.
Yeah.
Like Spider-Man's now on, what, volume 7? How many's Fantastic Four on at this point?
That must that's be... just restarted again,
yeah,
isn't
that's
it?
Well, there's a movie coming out.
Yeah.
So, you know. And they've not restarted Superman with the number one just because there's a new movie coming out, but they have started a new Superman title.
Yes.
Superman Unlimited, Dan Slott.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No.
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it?
It's Dan Slott.
Right.
And all the good and bad that entails. It's
so,
perfectly readable fun.
Okay.
It's very summer blockbustery.
Yeah.
It's all the characters are present and correct. There's a high concept idea there.
Does it remind you of that time that he was the president of Clark Industries?
It does. It does. He's not talked about that yet. No, what he's done is an explosion has happened that has put kryptonite all over the world. And it's become this expensive mineral, making certain countries very, very wealthy.
Right.
But now that means that Superman is... he's done the reverse of what John Byrne did.
Well, I was going to say, isn't that also very similar to... It's alluded to, isn't it? Is it Kryptonite No More? Where they're using kryptonite as an experimental fuel.
Mm.
So... Okay.
So it's similar to that. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a good idea. And Superman can turn gold for 3 minutes and that immunes him to the kryptonite.
Okay.
But after that 3 minutes are up, he's human for a bit.
Right.
Which again sounds like Geoff Johns's exploding out of the energy. Do you remember that he did?
Yeah.
And then, but after that, he's human for 24 hours until his cells can start restoring.
It's Ultraman.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right, okay.
But it's, like I say, it's fun. And I like that they've took it forward again. Perry's retired and Lois is now editor-in-chief of the Daily Planet.
Right, okay.
That's a nice move. Mm. I quite like. Jimmy's not a Cub reporter anymore. He's moved up.
Yeah.
So there's these little changes that they've made while still keeping more or less everything the same.
Okay, yeah.
But at least it gives you illusion that, well, they're married now with kids and she's got a new job. It's a step forward by her.
But it's still...
But it's a step forward. Yeah. As opposed to other things that aren't. Anyway, do we have anything else to discuss before we get into the heavy topic?
I don't think so.
I don't know, because there's not really a lot happening at the minute.
No new movies.
Well, Superman's out next week as we record this.
Yes.
They're doing the tour thing. Have you seen James Gunn's done a playlist?
No.
For each of the characters? Because he's not done a Guardians type soundtrack.
Okay.
But he's done a playlist for each of the characters on Spotify.
He's still done it.
Yeah, which is quite fun.
Okay.
Yeah, I was listening to it the other day. It's quite fun. Clark apparently liked Jimmy Eat World.
I mean, he looks like it.
Yeah, he looks like a Jimmy Eat World fan. Oh, it's all fun. And Lex has got one. Lois has got one. It's all, you know. And then Fantastic Four's out and all that stuff.
Is that out soon already?
Yeah. Okay. It's not getting any buzz, is it? From my point of view.
It's not. That I've seen anywhere.
If there's any buzz around a superhero movie at the minute, I'll see Superman. Even your sister.
Yeah.
Because I've got tickets to see it. I can't see it opening weekend.
Right.
Because we're busy. But the Monday, I've got the Monday off.
Yeah.
Because we're in the summer holidays now.
Right,
So I've booked the Monday off and I'm going watching the 10 o'clock screening that morning and I was going on my own.
Yeah.
And then we went watching Jurassic World. And your sister's watching the trailer going, when are you going watching this, Dad?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going watching it on Monday at 10 o'clock. She said, all right, can I come?
Yeah.
Fine. Another ticket.
Yeah.
So the trailer made your sister come and see it.
It even had a Love Island crossover.
Has that been on yet?
It's been on.
Has it?
It was the day that you messaged me.
Because
it was the one that we decided we weren't going to watch it anymore.
Because you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who robbed some people who knew somebody that was on Love Island.
Tenuous link to watch that absolute...
When I read it to your mum, and your mum's like, what? That's two steps removed.
It's not even drama. Like, I love a bit of drama, but it's just bickering. But anyway, they did it, and it's...
What was it? Tell me, please, so I don't have to watch it.
So, all the men dress up as Superman, all the women dress up as Lois Lane, and they do some posing and stuff like that, and then they pick up newspapers, and it's like, Superman is... courageous, and then they've got to talk about who's the most courageous, who's the least courageous. Superman is humble. Who's the most humble? Who's the least humble? But it's quite
funny.
Is it
as dreadful as it sounds, or is it funny?
Yeah, I mean,
because Love Island's awful. Love Island's an awful show.
The narrator was quite funny because he was just like, "Oh, what is this? Just a surprisingly well-funded sponsor." So they're very upfront about the fact that this is a weird thing, but they paid really well to do it.
Oh, right, so DC have gone to them and said, do this for us.
Yeah.
Because we want to reach this demographic.
Basically, yeah.
Right, okay, fair enough. Yeah. Well, I texted Mike Bailey, said they're doing a thing, because I don't even know if Love Island's a thing in America.
It is, but they've got an American version.
And because I was just going, I know there's an Australian version.
Yeah.
Because we show that one as well.
Right.
And we show that, but I don't think I've ever seen... the American one over here. I've seen the Australian one, I've seen the British one. I've seen enough of them to know this isn't for me.
Well, apparently it used to be more dramatic. They used to be able to do whatever they wanted, but there's restrictions in place now, so...
What's the point of that, then?
I don't know.
Surely the whole point of the show is that's what you're watching
it
for.
Yeah, yeah.
You're watching it for the sex, right?
But no, they're allowed maybe a little bit of, you know, soft play now, but that's it.
I'm just going to stick watching Open House on Channel 4. Well, you know, they get down and dirty on that show. So, yeah, so all of that's happened, will have happened by the time this comes out.
Yeah.
At the end of, what are we in now? Well, we're only 2 weeks away from this being released. We're quite late on this one. Anyway, so all of that drivel's happening. We'll let you know what I thought of Superman next time we record, because I should have seen it.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, you won't have, will you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I've gotten around to it.
Yeah.
I only managed to go see F1 because I had nothing to do that day.
Right. Were you doing anything? Oh, yeah, you work that Monday. You can't come with us, can you? Oh, well. Anyway, that's offshore banter. We don't really need to discuss that on mic.
Little peek behind the curtain.
Okay. So, shall we go into Onward Towards Our Noble Death by Shigeru Mizuki?
Yes. War, huh? What is it good for?
Absolutely nothing. Say it again.
Well, I mean, it's not really strictly true, is it? You know, we might not like to admit it, but there are some good things that have come out of the many, many, many wars that we've fought over the years. You know, after all, every cloud must have a silver lining, no matter how hard you have to look. And just think of all the technological advancements that we've had, like cars and the internet. And what about all the advancements in medicines? Some good must come out of all the death and horror, otherwise what would be the point of it all? Slowly looks to camera. Now, one thing war, or any major political movement like war, does is provoke. It provokes the worst of people and the best of people. It challenges. It demands you to meet it head on and decide who you are. Where do you stand? What are your beliefs? We touched on it in the last episode, and we're kind of seeing it now, literally right now on our television screens, on the radio and in the newspapers. We're seeing horrific things on a near daily basis, like war, and it's become hard not to become numb to it, and that is unless you already are. And who could blame you? Everything is political. Even the act of intentionally not being political is in of itself a political act. Now, who do we look to in these times? The answer is simple. We look to the creators of the world. We look to artists, poets and authors, even actors and musicians. They condense into words and imagery the thoughts and feelings that maybe we can't imagine ourselves. But upon seeing or hearing, everything starts to make sense. Whether you agree with the politics or not, is it an artist's job to distill the events of the world into something that we can clearly perceive? And to go on further, it's an artist's job to ensure that the art that they create is not necessarily easily digestible. It is as much the artist's job to challenge, it is our job to be challenged. It is our job to be challenged and to sit and to think and process what we've seen. Do we agree? Do we not agree? Why? Do we question ourselves and our beliefs, or do we turn our back and ignore what we don't like to hear? To dance around a rather topical issue, to stay both evergreen on the podcasting airwaves and to avoid any potential grumblings in the email and social media department, there have been several instances of politically challenging creatives being on the receiving end of major punishments for what they say, be they public outrages, concert cancellations, visa issues, and so on and so forth. But despite all of that, where would we be without art? It is the foundation of our social conscience. We need art, and the art that comes out of times of war is just as important as cars and internet. In some other world, Marvin Gaye didn't ask what's going on. Bruce Springsteen didn't write Born in the USA. Stallone didn't depict the effects of PTSD as Rambo. Picasso didn't paint the Guernica. Joe Kubert didn't stamp issues of Sergeant Rock with Make War No More. Captain America didn't fight the Nazis. And Superman didn't fight the Klan. A world without political art is a lesser world.
Not to interrupt you, but look at where Rambo went once Stallone took control of it. That is a prime example of my theory of first film locked on, stone cold, five-star classic, and a bunch of shitty sequels.
Now, to tie this all together in a neat little bow, there is one more piece of political, or you don't think...
I don't know, I genuinely don't think it is.
That I would like to bring in the mix, and that is this single volume manga by an artist known as Shigeru Mizuki. Now, there's a good chunk of you who probably haven't heard of Mizuki before, or even his work, and that's completely unsurprising.
There's one sat right here.
Strangely, despite being a huge household name in Japan, Mizuki's works were never translated until 2010, and so never left Japan. So, who is he? Mizuki was born in Osaka in 1922. As the middle child, he grew up to be a bit of a scrapper, going around and picking fights, but was also considered to be something of an artistic prodigy and was featured in local newspapers, as well as having a solo exhibition at a young age. He also developed an interest in the supernatural and urban folklore that would become the foundation of his future success. Like many other young men, Mizuki was drafted into the Imperial Army in 1942 at the age of 20 and was sent to the New Britain island, Papua New Guinea. During his time on the island, Mizuki would contract malaria, watch childhood friends die, and even lost his arm in an Allied forces air raid. This singular event would forever change Mizuki as a person. As the only survivor of the unit, Mizuki was ordered to die by his superiors, an order he considered to be ridiculous. The Japanese army carried with it a bastardized sense of Bushido from the days of the samurai, and soldiers were told to seek out their noble deaths, as to die for Japan and the emperor would be a show of great strength and solidarity. From this point, Mizuki carried with him a sense of pacifism and goodwill. In fact, Mizuki intentionally made the monsters and creatures of his yokai genre only appear during times of peace and not war. While recovering at a hospital in Rabaul, Mizuki would befriend the local Tolai tribe's people, who offered him land, food, and even a wife, which he declined. He was tempted to stay, but a Japanese doctor shamed him, telling he needed to return home to his own people. He had always planned to return to Rabaul and the tribe's people there, but due to the Japanese occupation, his own injuries, and the conviction of his brother as a war criminal for executing POWs, all got in the way of that. Following the war, Japan and its people were poor, dirt poor, and jobs were hard to come by, especially to those with very little prospects like Mizuki. He would bounce around from job to job before becoming a kamishibai artist, painting backgrounds and storyboards for street performers. He would dabble with drawing manga before publishing his debut, Rocketman, in 1957. From then, he would draw numerous books both on war and his specialist subject, yokai. In Japan, Mizuki is most fondly remembered for his yokai work. His characters would appear throughout multiple manga, cartoons, and even a whole street in the Tottori Prefecture that was appropriately renamed to Shigeru Mizuki Road and adorned with bronze statues of his characters. His yokai would even go to inspire filmmakers such as Takashi Miike and Hayao Miyazaki. If you've ever seen My Neighbor Totoro and other Ghibli films similar, then you've seen the shadow of Mizuki's influence. Finally in the West, his Showa, The History of Japan, Kitaro, Nononba, and Hitler biographies would be translated and released by Montreal-based Drawn and Quarterly, giving Mizuki a new and much wider audience. On November 30th, 2015, he collapsed at home after a heart attack and passed away in hospital, and he's buried in Shofu, Tokyo. Zach Davison, manga translator and friend of Mizuki, wrote his obituary, The Life and Death of Shigeru Mizuki, 1922-2015, on the Comics Journal, and had this to say. Mizuki was profoundly spiritual and believed in an invisible world that surrounded us. Many of his stories encouraged people not to fret too much about his transient life. In one strip, he had two cats telling the reader, "After all, we're only passing through this world. It isn't worth making a big fuss about." The afterlife was as real to him as the physical world. He commissioned his own tomb in his 60s and referred to it as his new home, but he often joked about looking forward to moving into his new home, but not too soon. He felt life was precious, and happiness was the only thing worth living for. An Epicurean through and through, to Mizuki, the seven deadly sins were signs of only a body in good working order. Also in the book Dreamland Japan, Fred Schott recalls seeing Mizuki in San Francisco in 1993, returning from an arduous research trip in Hopi Indian Territory in Arizona. Already in his 70s, Mizuki exuded vitality. While his younger companions were exhausted by a late night of dinner and drinking, Mizuki wanted to go to a porn store and check out girly mags. As someone who had cheated death so many times, Mizuki didn't want to waste a minute of being alive. In his 90s, his Twitter feed was full of pictures of himself sucking down McDonald's French fries like he was receiving communion. If there was pleasure life could give, he would take it. It's important, or at least I think so, to keep this idea of Mizuki in mind whilst reading this. Mizuki had seen death and cheated it. He had seen his friends lose their lives at young ages because their country told them to. He was even told to die himself, but refused. In all of his war stories, there is an overwhelming sense of an anger that he refuses to hold on to. He's very angry that his country cost him the lives of his friends, his arm, and even the lives of those back home who didn't fight in the war. But to hold on to anger is to not move on with life. When every day could be our last, why would we not choose to continue to walk forward and grab on to every experience, every happiness that we can? So, with all that context set up, we delve today into arguably Mizuki's most important books, Onward Towards Our Noble Deaths, first published in 1973, then published by Drawn and Quarterly in 2011, translated by Jocelyn Allen, which is these nice little book here. And the thing I like about these Drawn and Quarterly books is they're all semi-uniform. Various thicknesses, but really, really nice books. There's context in there. There's an introduction. There's always a backup bit at the back. This one is quite a disappointing interview with Mizuki himself.
Yeah, you didn't get a lot from the interview, no. Did you? He was either he was being obstinate,
yeah,
in just deliberately answering the questions in very short sentences,
yeah,
or he didn't find the questions particularly challenging,
yeah.
And I wonder, was the interview just sent to him via email?
Maybe, yeah,
because it doesn't feel like a conversation. It just feels like here's a question, answer it,
yeah.
And the thing that you alluded to there in your exceptional introduction, well done. You'd not dwelled on the fact that he lost an arm in this.
Yeah.
I presume it wasn't his drawing arm, or did he learn to draw?
Yeah, because he'd always been a bit of an artist around it. But it was only after that, when obviously he needed to make money, that he started drawing more and more and more.
Right.
And it goes into it more in depth in the Showa History of Japan, which is four thick volumes, where he covers everything from the beginning of the Showa era right up to the end in the 80s. That is very political. That's the history of Japan. Obviously, the history of Japan is also the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And then when the war starts coming into place, the war bits are probably some of the best stuff, because it's also an autobiography. So he's discussing, why did the war happen? What happened during the war? Oh, also, I was drafted. What happened when I was in the war? So he spends a good chunk of it doing that. And yeah, he discusses being with the tribe, losing the arm, having to come back as a survivor, which, you know, was a bit of a shameful thing back then as well.
Yeah, the first thing that I noticed when you lent it, this is it's a nice little package.
Mm.
It's got the little flaps at the front giving you the biographies of who the creators are. There's a little picture of him at the back. He looks very happy.
He does.
On his photo. And it's like a proper paperback novel.
Yeah.
It is a really good way of packaging comics towards people that think of comics as being somehow a lesser art form.
And there's a lot of context in there. The war doesn't necessarily require context, but there's a lot of in there, and there's a lot of kind of specific Japanese history context that it explains in the back. You don't need to do any research outside of what this book gives you.
No, you can. One of the things that I did enjoy about it, and one of the things I like about Lone Wolf and Cope, is exactly the same as this. They've got the little glossary at the back that tells you what certain words mean. Now, in this case, it actually has little footnotes.
Yeah.
Telling you what page this happened and what page that happened, and the like the Hanafuda cards, the Japanese playing cards. So in the book, he just calls them the Hanafuda cards.
Yeah.
And then you have a look at the back and it gives you the context there for what it means, and you go, all right, okay, and you carry on reading the story.
Which is one of those things, because I'm a big fan of the Yakuza games, and that's why I had a new Hanafuda anyway, because of playing games like Ocho Kabu and Koi Koi and things like that, which is it's fun. Unlike Showa, the History of Japan, Noble Deaths is a fictionalized autobiography of Mizuki's time in the war. It follows a group of troops stationed on a small island as they struggle with the day-to-day life, as well as the US Army's capture of the island. As the numbers slowly dwindle, only a few survive the US raids and their bombing runs. Those that do survive are then sent to march towards the Americans, onwards towards their noble ends. Like you were mentioning earlier, that's pretty much the synopsis of it. It's very brief in its plot, but in its strengths, how it forces you to slow down and get to know these people.
Yeah, if you're doing a synopsis of the plot of this, it's a bunch of Japanese are told to hold this relatively innocuous and useless island to the death.
Yeah.
That's it. That is literally the plot of this 300-page book.
yeah.
Because, again, it's not about the plot.
No.
It's about the characters and the situations the characters find themselves in.
Yeah. So one of the things this book shows is Mizuki's style probably at its best. It's misleadingly simple in its caricature, cartoonish characters, which then contrast highly against his super detailed work. He's very sparse with that detail work. He knows when to prioritize storytelling and when to zoom out and slow down and force you to take in what he needs you to see. There are pages and pages of super simplistic caricatures just dossing about, but everything outside of that is super highly rendered, sometimes coming across as a black and white photo. US soldiers are depicted as these shadowy brutes compared to the whimsical Japanese soldiers. Generals and higher ranking officers are shown to be quite stiff, you know, their facial expressions are never changing. The jungle is dense and thick and full of so much detail that it's easy for us, the readers, to get lost in it as much as it was for the soldiers to get lost in. And more importantly, I think, is Mizuki's detail of the dead. Bodies and injuries are painstakingly rendered, and some of the same characters who have previously appeared as cartoony blobs throughout the story become realistic figures in death. You know, Mizuki wants us to laugh with him at the ridiculous of war and show how the regular soldiers spent a lot of the time messing about with their mates and playing pranks, but within their death, he wants us to respect them. They become real, detailed people at that point.
That was one of the things that hit me from starting to read it, that I loved how his art switches from panel to panel between, like, the introduction, Konopo, New Britain, end of 1943, that absolutely beautiful two-page splash of Papua New Guinea and the trees and the landscape and the boats arriving. Look at the detail of how beautiful that is on the first couple of pages. Like, the line work is gorgeous. And then the characters rock up on the next page and it becomes a cartoon.
Yeah.
And I quite liked the cartoonishness of the characters reflected in the realness of the environment, which kind of weirdly made the characters stand out more and made them feel more real. And I also found it interesting that if this hadn't been drawn by a native, you could look at the artistic depictions of them here and think, oh, that's a bit racist. But it's been drawn by somebody who was there. So is that? So it's not then, is it?
No,
because he can't be.
He very much leans into caricature territory, I think, to make him stand out. Because one of the things as well, you've got the diagram of characters at the front, and that's a kind of good example as to how he draws the characters. There's an argument to be made that, especially with the number of characters, there's a lot of the sameness with some of them. And so it's hard to kind of forget who's who. I mean, that is until later on when numbers start dwindling, but the very outlandish stylized caricatures that are still all quite similar. So if there is a critique, it's that. But what he's doing is he's kind of going out of his way to make everyone so different, and so you have to do caricatures to do that.
Well, when I did actually look at the cast of characters before I read it, and I thought, oh, this is going to be exhausting remembering who all these people are.
Yeah.
But I slightly disagree with it. I think every single face is unique. I think he does an exceptional job of coming up with unique faces for all these characters. Even when an awful lot of them wear glasses and some of them have pointy chins and round faces, there's a uniqueness to them all.
Yeah.
So even if you don't remember their names as you go into the story, you've got a visual idea of who they all are.
Yeah.
And secondly, as you're reading it, it doesn't really matter.
No.
You get used to the relationships between them.
And I think as well, you start remembering people based on what happened to them rather than their name.
Yeah, and you just, as with any good story, you get sucked into it as you read along. And within like 30, 40 pages of it, I kind of felt like I knew them all.
Yeah.
And that helped, even if you're not, right, well, that's Fujikura and that's Norinama. Even if you can't go, that's who that is by name.
Yeah, yeah.
You know who they are and what their function is in the story straight away.
Yeah. And the pacing's really, really nice, especially this kind of slow opening, is it doesn't really contextualize a lot. It basically just says, the war's on, we were sent here to do it.
Yeah, we were sent here to do this.
And it kind of eases into it quite comedically. You know, they're all hanging out at this whorehouse trying to get in before
the whorehouse stuff was brilliant. Because I love that they're like, it shuts at 5.
Yeah.
So the prostitutes work 9 till 5. So to them, it's just like an office job. And they're ordered to go by their superior officer, which I thought was hysterical. Go and get it out your system.
Yeah.
Go and do what you do. Because once we're over on the island, you're out of luck. And they show up at sort of like 4 to 5. And the woman who runs it is like, guys, I'm knackered. There's a queue out the door.
It's like, oh, but he got to go twice.
I thought that was hysterical. She's like, guys, I'm shattered. I've worked a full day. And she's literally just like, I've worked a full day in this crappy office job.
Yeah.
I'm shattered and I want to go home, but it's a whorehouse.
But what's really quite funny is they then just decide to start singing. Now, songs are one of those recurring themes of this. Right from the start, you know, the book opens with lyrics from the song Kawaii Suchan, which was a big theme throughout this book, is the hardships of the everyday soldier. You know, some being funny and some being steeped in sad stoicism.
But the interesting thing with that as well is the funny one becomes not funny at the end.
So when the whole house shuts and they all start singing, why am I working this shitty job? Yeah. Even the whores have it better than us.
Yeah.
That then becomes the deathly lament at the end.
That was my only problem with the translation of it. Jocelyn Allen does a great job with the dialogue. Even if sometimes it doesn't quite fit the balloons properly.
Yeah.
And there are times where a head is in the middle of a balloon.
Yeah.
And even as a seasoned comic reader, so am I going straight across here? Am I reading around the head? But you figure all that out quite away. But the translation of the songs are slightly odd because the lyrics don't rhyme in English.
No.
So the words lack context. So the old Japanese war song, The Prostitute's Lament, doesn't really work translated into a song.
No.
Although the sentiment, why am I stuck in this shitty job, does work.
Yeah.
So you get the feeling of it. You get what they're talking about, even though you're a little bit, I don't get that this is a song.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't matter, does it?
One of the other themes, it's basically just the kind of day-to-day life, but also how the higher-ups just beat up and slap the soldiers around. There's a very big difference between the career soldiers and the enlisted soldiers. The drafted soldiers get essentially the shitty end of the stick. They're beaten the most. And most of the times it's played for laughs, you know.
Yeah, abuse is played for laughs.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, you've been an idiot. Slap, slap, slap.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things, especially the more you go through it, what starts off as just a higher up beating the lower downs becomes this bigger image. That's essentially what this is. The whole chain of command is just beat the people beneath you into submission. Just constantly, the drafted ones just constantly getting the naff end.
Well, that's what was interesting about it in comparison to, obviously, we're more familiar with Western war stories.
Mm.
The idea that these characters aren't fearsome.
No.
They're not even well-trained.
No.
They aren't warriors on a mission.
No.
They're not killers. They're just people.
Yeah, it's very
drafted.
It's very different from, you know, Easy Company and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well to see it, to look at a World War II story from the Japanese point of view.
Yeah.
We're used to seeing it from our point of view. And it's one of those rare instances where we were the good guys.
Mm.
And there's many, many wars in the history of the planet where we weren't the good guys.
Yeah.
Depending on your point of view. But in World War II, that's how it's always depicted. And the Japanese are always these implacable foes.
Yeah.
And they're always, like, really well-trained and savage.
Yeah.
And one of the things, I don't know, it was a general in the US Army when he came over here. I remember reading this interview when we covered battlefields.
Okay.
Some of the Garth Ennis stuff. And he said the hardest thing to get through to the Allied troops was kill or be killed.
Yeah.
Because we're not raised like that.
Mm.
We're raised that life is, if you can take them prisoner, you take them prisoner.
Yeah.
But he said you were fighting the Germans, the Japanese, and that wasn't their philosophy.
Yeah.
They were going to kill you.
Yeah.
So you had to kill them. And it's interesting to see that from the other side, that you look at this bunch, they're not killers.
And it's that kind of thing that Mizuki does really well. He understands why the war happened, but he doesn't like it. And this, you are right, the narrative in and of itself is not inherently political.
I don't think it is.
It has the shadow of that above it. It has to, it's the war.
It's what we discussed when we did Smashes the Clown. It's that the story doesn't exist without the politics of the situation.
Yeah.
What is going on in the world informs this story. Yeah. And this story doesn't exist without what is going on in the world.
But what he's doing as well is, this isn't, we were the good guys, they were the bad guys. This isn't maybe in another life we could have been friends with the Americans kind of thing. This is just, we were in this naff situation and we were just guys.
Yeah.
We didn't want to be there.
That's what I mean about, I don't think this story is inherently political.
Yeah.
At no point does he address the Japanese's role in World War II.
No.
Because that's not what it's about.
No.
At no point does he address what World War II was about.
No.
Because that's not what the story's about.
No.
The story is, and in defense of your argument, the characters are here because of political decisions.
Yeah.
But they themselves aren't political.
No.
They don't hate Americans.
No.
or us, or Australians, or any of the allies.
They just fight them because they have to.
They're just being told they are the enemy, fight them.
Yeah.
They don't hate anybody. And I found that such an interesting juxtaposition on how the Japanese are normally portrayed in these movies.
Well, I made the note towards the end, but it kind of works. Now, what's interesting is there's no kind of... We're used to those kind of stereotypes.
Yes.
We're used to the stereotypes of the Germans, the Nazis. Yep. We're used to the stereotypes of the Japanese army. This, it just doesn't bother.
No.
The Americans aren't depicted as these big, burly, MacArthur-esque bad guys. They're barely in it. They're just more of this looming presence, more so than anything. But there's no... This isn't propaganda.
No.
Which is very easy for it to fall into. You know, a lot of these wartime comics fall into propaganda territory. This doesn't. This is the exact opposite. This is saying this is why war sucks for the normal people who've got to fight it.
Yeah. What was interesting about this as well, more than anything, was just the hunger.
Yeah.
Like, an army marches on its stomach and these guys have basically got one packet of rice a day. To last them through this entire campaign. And they are doing nothing. All the way through the book, really. From the minute they land on the island, they talk about nothing but being hungry.
I mean, which is perfectly contrasted against the higher-ups eating bowls and bowls of rice. But with it just being about the daily routine of the soldiers and how they just mucked about, there's a lot of kind of danger in that. There's one scene where they're just carrying logs to make shelter and one of them falls and breaks his arm under the log.
Yeah.
And then there's the themes of, you know, there's no medicine available. The area itself is really oppressive.
They're going to get malaria. They can be bitten by ticks. Yeah. There's all these just external forces.
Yeah. And there's so much stuff going on that even the smallest thing has this looming shadow of death, you know, surrounded by war in this alien territory. Any moment could be your last, and for many, it is. As we get to our first death, which happens off-panel, a soldier just seemingly falls out of a boat and into the river.
Yeah.
His lower body only being found days later.
Yeah, because I mentioned that to your mum, because they're having a chat.
Yeah.
But the panel, the art, stays on the guy in the front of the boat.
Because he just carries on having a conversation. It's like one of those things where you're walking down a street
and somebody's falling down a manhole.
And you're talking to someone, but you don't realise that you've kind of overtaken them and they're not there anymore.
Yeah. And so he turns around and suddenly he's not in the back of the boat. And, like, there was no splash. You didn't hear him fall in. You didn't see him fall in.
Yeah.
So you've not actually got any idea what happened to him. And it's only later on, like you said, that the bottom half of his body...
Yeah, he does a double take and he's just like, oh, have you gone?
Suddenly he's just... And then they start going, well, was he eaten by an alligator? And the guys, I think his hat fell off and he was reaching for it, but he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how he fell out the boat.
And it's kind of like... Death comes very, very slowly, but it is definitely there because you've just had pages and pages of just enjoying these characters, and then all of a sudden it's like, literally no one is safe.
But I love as well that the gossip starts.
Yeah.
Somebody say, you shot at the gator, and nothing like that happened.
No.
At all. He doesn't even know it was an alligator.
No.
He knows nothing. The one minute he was there, the next minute he wasn't. It's really interesting.
And then we get to the second death, which comes in the form of a hungry soldier shoveling a whole fish down into the mouth and getting stuck and suffocating him. It's one of those, writing for the Comics Journal, Sean Michael Robinson said that he found the sequence and the explanation for the death grotesque and unbelievable. There is an argument. Yeah, it's slightly unbelievable. And he even argues that if this is... conveyed as this is a semi-autobiographical account of what happened, how do you argue with that, even as silly as it is? If someone did die like that, well, you know. But earlier in his essay, he does mention himself that death is everywhere in this book, and it isn't honourable. Death comes through battle, but it also comes from accident like these. It's just one of those constant reminders that it could come at any moment.
Well, I loved the fishing scene. I loved them throwing grenades in to knock the fish out.
Yeah.
And then, he just picks it up and he stuffs it all in his mouth and it gets stuck there and he chokes to death. And is it silly? Yes. He's still dead, whether it's silly or not.
Yeah.
So, you know, the environment is shown to good effect as being dangerous. Like you were just talking about, even the act of catching something to eat.
Yeah.
I love that they get to New Year. And New Year's like this big deal for them, isn't it? This big celebration. and they're really pissed off that they have to work through New Year's.
Because,
like, as far as they still have to do their daily routines. They still have to find food. They still have to find shelter. They don't get the day off.
But when war does come to an island, it comes with a statement. A low-flying B-26 on patrol spots a Japanese scout and just guns him down.
Yeah.
By this point in the book, despite the couple of deaths, there's such an element of comfort. We've been sucked in. We're hanging out with these guys. But then suddenly from this point, there's just this big cloud of dread that looms over everything.
Yeah, because originally when I was reading it, I was like, well, why did they start strafing it? But yeah, they spot them, don't they?
Mm.
Right, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And again, like we talked about before, to these guys, to the guys we're following in this story, it's just a swarm of marauders that come in and start shooting at them.
Mm.
We don't, you know, like I said, we don't see the enemy. And in this case, the enemy is the Allies, which is us. We don't see them. And they're not portrayed as caricatures or anything in any way like we would portray the Japanese or did in previous eras.
They're just there. It's a swarm of planes in the sky or just bullets coming from trees. There's very little depictions of the Allied forces.
No. And the death as well has all been either comical or accidental so far, which is worth noting as we go into where we're going next.
So, like I mentioned earlier, Bushido was a big thing in Japan that the Imperial Army brought back from the Edo period. We've all seen films or read comics about the nobility of seppuku, to kill oneself for honour.
Yeah.
Only the army brought this belief back in an overly bastardised way. Just as it was better for a samurai to die with honour than to become a lowly ronin, it was better to die in battle than to return at all. This reached its peak towards the end of the war when Japan was becoming increasingly poorer and more desperate to win a war that it was losing so badly. Japan's technology became stagnant as the funds dried and so kamikaze pilots became more prominent. The issue this brought up was just how do you convince a soldier to fly a plane into a boat or a soldier to run into a hail of bullets? Bushido. You're not a soldier or a pilot. You're a noble warrior who will forever be remembered for what you do. And that becomes the big driving force here for the rest of it. Suddenly that Bushido kicks right in as the Allied forces land on the island.
Yeah, I know that Superman Wonder Woman was just a superhero thing.
Yeah.
That was in no way attempting to depict the real war.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't do. It was being written as a romp.
Yeah.
But then when you compare it, again, there's not really any comparison, but you compare how that depicted what was going on in attacks in the war to this, and even more, it just solidifies that idea I have that, no, stop it. Stop putting superheroes in World War II. Just knock that crap off, because it doesn't work in any way, especially when you're reading a story like this about real people. It was interesting to read more about the idea that them going home would have been a disgrace.
Yeah.
Even though, like, there's not really any strategic value to this particular. It's nearer to Australia than anything else. So it's well out the way.
Yeah.
I did look it up. In World War One, this island was owned by the Germans.
Okay, right.
And then when the Germans were stripped of the possessions after the end of World War One, it was given to Australia. So it's an Australian-owned island by default.
Yeah.
So I did wonder why there wasn't more of a presence by the Australians in the story. But ultimately, it doesn't matter, does it?
Mm.
If it's based on a real event, then
they
weren't there.
Yeah.
So it's simple as that. The other thing I like learning about here was the Kempetage. Am I saying that right?
The Kempia?
It's something like that. The Japanese Gestapo.
Yeah.
Basically. Ostensibly formed to be military police.
Yeah.
They became the bane of the Japanese people's lives, taking the little amount of power they were given by the government and not only brutalising Allied prisoners, but keeping foreign women as comfort women.
Yeah.
But they also took it further by punishing their own people.
It's why the people of Okinawa still are very distrustful of the mainlanders. Quite famously, the soldiers and the Japanese Gestapo, they came to Okinawa, which is this island. Again, it's one of those that historically there's been US bases on there because it's kind of close to Hawaii and things like that.
Yeah.
But they came over to Okinawa and they were just like, you need to shelter us, you need to give us your food and your woman, because the Allied forces are going to come over and they're going to steal and rape from you, so you've got to give them us. And then it was them that then did the stealing and killing and raping. And so we see one of the marching platoons, which is depicted as really great, in the trudging through the rain throughout all the mud. And then one of them is shot by a US soldier. He's hit, but he's still alive. And despite his protest and he's screaming, he's pinned down and he has his little finger chopped off. The little finger being a sign that he died in battle. But he's left there alive to die in the rain and the mud. That little finger and the narrative that he died nobly being more important than his actual life.
Yeah.
It's a kind of horrific scene that's just moved past quickly. They just, he's hit, that's it.
Yeah.
And they pin him down and he protests, but they're like, nah,
yeah, he says, I'm not dead.
Yeah.
The tank attack, the art in the tank cat stuff is absolutely gorgeous. When the entire sequence, we've talked about how the art changes styles between the cartoony depictions of the characters to just the threat being realistic. When they land and the troops come swarming up, this is 6 or 7 pages.
Of just...
Just some of the most glorious pencil art I've seen in a comic in a long time.
Mm.
And it's, you're not hiding behind computer colouring.
No.
Or anything like that, or farting around with computers to make it look glossy.
Mm.
It is literally just this guy and his pencil. And it's absolutely gorgeous.
And there's just so much rendering.
Yeah. And how much of it is... Because it looks just like it's pencils.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like there's inks going on here.
Or very, very fine.
Yeah. It's absolutely gorgeous, the artwork. Which is a weird thing to say.
Yeah.
That in the middle of this story where all these people are getting slaughtered, that the artwork has suddenly become so realistic.
Yeah.
Page 159 is absolutely stunning. It's, yeah, the I'd love to see the real art for this and not as it even printed. I mean, it's all black and white, so it's not going to be that different, but I'd love to see his pencil strokes.
Yeah.
Like when you see the art in galleries and you can see the tip X and all that stuff. I'd love to see what the real art for this looks like.
And then you get to this point now, the Americans have landed on the island. We then start to see all of the kind of career soldier higher-ups who become... Probably
suddenly more involved.
Yeah, and they kind of come, if there is a bad guy in this, it's them, I guess. But the higher officers, they know the attack wouldn't work. They knew that it would fail. And so their plan is to just throw human bodies at the US in an all-out attack.
Mm.
They refer to the great master Kusunoki. Kusunoki Masashige was a 14th century samurai from the Kawachi province who fought for the Emperor Go-Daigo. His conduct and his eventual death are seen as perfect examples of Bushido, and that's who he wants to become. He wants to have that nobleness, that legacy, and so his plan literally is to just throw bodies at the US.
Yeah, and it does become at this point that they won't even let them, because the captain actually pushes back.
Yeah.
A little bit later on.
Captain says, look, Honda, yeah.
If we retreat, let them have a minute, give them some food, take the high ground, we can hold them off. Possibly indefinitely.
Well, they say, don't they, 3 days of guerrilla fighting and we can overturn this. And
then,
but the idea of guerrilla fighting, so no.
No, we'd much rather to go into battle and die.
And which becomes almost funny. Later on, when his higher-ups are just like, oh my god, he's so idiot, like, he's such an idiot, why didn't he just back off a little?
Why didn't he just let them retreat
and
then take them from the high ground, and they could have held them off?
Yeah.
Because, again, the allies that have landed on the island don't know how many of these Japanese soldiers there are.
Yeah.
So they could have kept that going for a long time. My other question going into this was, why was New Britain of strategic importance? Because it doesn't look it on a map.
That's a part of the plot as well towards the end, isn't it?
Just seemed to me like this is just a massive waste of resources and men.
Which it was.
Yeah.
We get to a great example, I think, of just some really good environmental storytelling on page 167. Yeah, we just get this throwaway panel just at the top of just some birds crushed underneath some treads, I guess.
I presume it's the tank treads, yeah.
It's just a little tiny throwaway panel, but it's just the presence of people on this island has started to destroy and kill the island.
You can read it nowadays as well as a climate thing, that this island was lovely and perfectly preserved.
Yeah.
And then humanity shows up, whichever side of the argument they're on.
Yeah.
And they ruin it.
Yeah. I just a thought when I came across it, was just like, it's only a tiny panel, but yeah.
He leans into that a little bit later on, though, when he shows you how much the trees have been destroyed.
Yeah.
And how much the landscape has suffered.
Yeah.
For essentially, again, what is a pointless fight.
And there's a lot of imagery of the debris and the destructed areas that really carries with it the ghosts of Hiroshima, I think. Just some of that imagery.
Yeah. Yeah, it also punctuates how quickly things happen after long periods of nothing. There's loads of time here where they're doing nothing. They're taking a piss, they're looking for food,
They're
arguing, they're talking about the fact they've not had sex in years because it feels like years to them. And mostly this shows soldiers dying in battle and asking, why are they here to die? What reason is it? Does it mean anything? It was such an interesting contrast to what you're used to seeing in these kinds of stories. And maybe it's just because I've not read enough of these. Maybe it's because what we're exposed to is largely only from our point of view.
Yeah.
Or whoever's point of view is making the film. It was quite sobering in many ways.
We get to an absolutely chilling bit with the Doctor. And the Doctor ends up being a really cool, interesting character towards the end, but he just says, I'm a doctor, my job is to extend the lives of these men, even if just for a few seconds. Essentially, as we saw earlier with the little finger, the doctor's job is to just make sure that the weapons last longer for a little bit longer, the weapons being the soldier. He's not really there to ease pain or to end suffering, he's there to extend the lives of men who can carry guns. But we get to Miura's sacrifice in a couple of pages, around here. And it's great, but in a not necessarily great way. We have so many war stories or films which just have this dramatic last stand. You know, the hero buys time for the other ones, goes down guns blazing, but he tries to do the same and is just shelled down into nothing. He runs out with these grenades, and next thing he knows, he's just gone.
Yeah.
It's his bravery and his efforts are just short-lived and futile.
Yeah, and it's here that it starts leaning into the violence a lot more. Kiramoto having his eye being shot out is gross, only because the series has largely eschewed violence up to this point. People died off-panel or choked.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden in the attack we're seeing heads and severed limbs and everything fly around. And it's like, just on 203, his head is literally blown off his body.
And it's almost gratuitous without being gratuitous.
Yep.
There is a point that grounds it all.
Yeah.
Now, one of the biggest tensions outside of the fighting comes from the behind-the-scenes decisions that affect the lives of all these soldiers. And it's something kind of familiar to a lot of us, you know, higher-ups deciding what we're going to do. While the soldiers rough it out and they go without food and they go without medicine, we've got officers hanging out here in proper buildings, eating rice and playing cards. They're not seeing the soldiers as anything other than cogs in their machine. The company commander, liaison essentially between the soldiers and the officers, argues that a noble death is stupid. If they resort to guerrilla tactics, they could defend this island for months.
Yeah.
But Commander Tadakoro, who is depicted greatly, he only ever has one facial expression, but he kind of becomes sterner and sterner. He's more focused on the glory of the death and the legacy that he could leave behind him. He's very much a kind of CV seeking career soldier. But just as his facial expression never changes, neither does his stance. And so ultimately the company are sent towards this futile end because of his decision, his firm decision to leave his legacy.
And this was my favorite bit of the book, just this back and forth between him, Tadakoro, and the captain Honda. Captain Honda. Just Honda being very, no, we can hold this position.
Yeah.
And he just being constantly overruled. This was my favourite section of the book, because like you said, the people who are out doing the job have absolutely no say whatsoever.
And up until this point, Tadakoro hasn't actually been out in the field yet.
No. So I loved this bit, because he was willing to say, no, I'm not just going to send these people to die for no reason whatsoever, which again is a contrast to what we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
How the Japanese portrayed in these kind of stories, where it's death or glory.
Yeah.
At all costs.
And at this point, it is death and glory, yeah. And that's it. Which is further reinforced in a couple of pages' time, where we get the doctor again, where basically he tells the wounded and those that can't move to use the grenades, implying heavily that if they cannot use a weapon, then stay there and be the weapon themselves.
Yeah.
This further emphasising the end is more important than to continue life.
Yeah.
And then we get to the end of Captain Honda, which is actually
quite affected
and quite a noble ending. His men are carrying him because he's injured. He knows he cannot fight in this injured state, but he also knows that he can't return alive. And so he orders his men to retreat. He forces them and they all walk away crying.
Yeah.
Because basically he knows that if he is to stay here and to die himself, he saved the lives of his men for a little longer.
Yeah, because he's saying, you retreated on my orders.
Yeah.
Tell them that.
Yeah.
So you were following orders. So he's saving them from disgrace.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you end up really quite liking Captain Honda at the end of it. Even though when he started, he was just a bit...
yeah.
He was just the same as all the others, really. Seems a bit weird. We know from Eastern culture that it would seem to preclude the idea that just to not obey the order of the suicide charge. Yet we see them do exactly that.
Yeah.
And Honda protects them from it. He doesn't want them to go blindly to their death. But like you said, the brass don't see it that way.
Mm.
They see it as that's the way to go out.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this is, I think this is why you carry on. And
it
don't
breaks
stop
it into
finished.
Chapters, though, yeah. as well. But it doesn't matter. It just...
No, it doesn't. You just keep going with it. I think I read this in pretty much one or two sittings.
Mm.
And then I would go back and make some notes about it. And then I'd read bits of it again to make sure I was getting it. Because that's the only problem with it. You're reading it as a manga, which obviously your generation is much more used to.
Mm.
But I'm still getting used to the idea of technically I'm reading it backwards. So there are panels every now and again where I've not read that right. And you go back and read it again just because of the panel on.
Yeah. And then, like we mentioned earlier, we get to the point now where the news gets back to Base HQ that Tadakoro plans this suicide charge, which they deem to be stupid.
Yeah.
But when they don't get any correspondence, they assume the battalion is already dead, and they announce the soldiers as having met their noble end.
Yeah.
When they find out then that there are survivors, they send one of their own to make sure that they do die in a charge, just to save themselves the embarrassment over their own mistake. Not only that, but the officer is also backed by military law to ensure that their own men die. Again, these men are sent to their deaths because the HQ made a mistake.
Yep. And they're sacrificed to cover up their mistake.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that story in other places before.
We get the whole scene here with the doctor, which is great. He heads back to HQ on his own and he just plainly spells out all of the themes of the book. He argues and questions the Imperial Army's hubris. He asks, do they not respect human life? He even asks, does respecting human life bring shame on the country?
Yeah.
His argument is constantly shut down and his fight is just as futile as the soldiers back on the island. And so he decides to shoot himself rather than be court-martialed for his desertion. His death is then deemed as regrettable, as the army still could have used him. His body is then burned and taken back to Cape St. George, where the soldiers are to be buried with the men.
Yeah.
Despite him leaving, no one who goes to that island gets out alive. Even in death, he is sent back to that island.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just get a little bit of humour here, one of the sadder chapters of the book. He goes to the island and he's making them feel all guilty. Why did you survive? Were you all And so Kitazaki starts bowing so low and so low that he starts sticking his ass out higher and higher. But then we lead into the rest of this sequence, which is genuinely great stuff. And Mizuki really drags out the pace here for maximum effect. Surviving the charge, Yamagishi and Kitazaki, they're pressured through guilt into accepting their noble ends at the hands of their superiors. But they don't get to fight. They don't get that end like the rest of their friends. Instead, they're sent down to a beach where they finish their final cigarettes and they worry not about themselves, but what their families will be told about their deaths. and then they're executed for being cowards in this really well drawn out sequence that goes back to this samurai imagery. All of this stuff is just so great and really just highlights the themes that we've been mentioning.
And you've got the last two before they also die in the final attack, having a conversation about you. He's telling him you can't drink the water.
Yeah.
And he's, why can't I drink the water? Because you're going to get amoebic dysentery. And he's like, really? That's what you're worried about?
It's like the bit in Return of the King, isn't it? It's like, oh, I need to save some food for the way back. Really? You think there's going to be a way back?
You think we're coming back? Just eat it. So I love that he's just said, I really don't care at this point.
No.
That was a nice touch.
But yeah, this final scene is just really, really powerful stuff, I think. All the different aspects of the book just coming together for one last crescendo. The soldiers sing their lament about working their shitty jobs before running into certain death, and it evokes this powerful sense of camaraderie amongst the group. We've come to become comrades with this group as well, and they're essentially just bumbling everyday men. They're more like us than the soldiers we read about in comics.
Yeah.
They're rapidly wiped out by the superior forces of the US weaponry, something that all the men knew would happen anyway. They knew what would happen and ran into it. And it further reinforces the fact that they were massively outgunned and outnumbered from the start. There was no tactical advantage from this island. And the art then slowly changes throughout this charge from the typical style to something so hyper-detailed. And, you know, in their death, these men are no longer cartoons. But they then become nothing but a sea of bones as well, as the earth kind of grows over them. Mm-hmm. As the killed, the camera and the sense of time pulls back as well. We see the after effects of this. You know, the earth just kind of grows over them and starts to heal. And then finally, after all this, you know, we end on a simple question, but one that casts a heavy shadow over everything we've just read. Was the position really so important that they had to go through such lengths to hold it? It's a haunting way to end such a book. It's such great stuff, this entire final scene.
Yeah, you've got your last survivor, and he's barely surviving.
Mm.
It actually says, Miruyama regained consciousness with a start as the egg laid by the flies in the bullet hole in his cheek began to hatch. And he can't see. He's still singing, why am I stuck working this shitty job? And then he's just seen by an allied soldier who says a Jap and just shoots him.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And it does such a great job as well. Is a big part of the book, even the name itself, is Noble End. And yet...
Well, the title's sarcastic, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. Nothing in this is noble.
Yeah.
And we get that at the end, we've got essentially a walking corpse who was just gunned down like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a...
That's it. It's not heroic. There's no cigar-chomping, wise-cracking men calling his men to make the charge for guts and glory. It's really sad. The characters are real people doing a dirty job. Mizuku tells his tale as only one who was there can tell it through the lens of the people involved. Interestingly, the story takes no overt political stance.
Mm.
I still think that.
Yeah.
He's not critical of Japan's involvement in World War II. He's not critical of World War II at all. He offers no criticisms or hatred for the Allies that killed all of his comrades. Instead, all he does is offer a look at the mundanity of war and a military system that decrees it's more honourable to die than to live.
Yeah. It's deeply powerful and personal. It's depressing and funny. It doesn't shy away from the horrors of war, nor does it ignore the foolishness of it.
Mm.
Again, it's written as someone who was there and who survived it, and who knows that if you can die at any moment, then you would choose to move on and to find happiness in some way. Like we've mentioned time and time again, you know, in a time when American and British comics still use these caricaturesque stereotypes of the quote-unquote bad guys, Mizuki chooses to ignore any potential stereotypes at all. He depicts the Allied forces of this shadowy but powerful presence. There's no definitive bad guy, only foolish people in powerful positions making foolish decisions. Mizuki's never scared to show how he feels about the Imperial Army, but never says it outright. And even when he does, he's armed with enough facts to back himself up and enough humour to engage audiences. At no point does he ever point the finger and blame the US or Japan for the Pacific Theatre. War was just simply something that happened in their lifetime, and all of them just had to do this shitty job.
Mm-hmm.
It's... Yeah, it is just what it is. And he is telling it as he saw it.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Which is weird.
Yeah, yeah.
it's interesting to sometimes read something that is outside of your perspective and realise that at the end of the day, people are all just people.
Yeah. Following the war and the withdrawal of MacArthur and his US soldier station in Japan, Japanese creators have been very, very vocal about their disappointment and anger about the decisions and actions of their government and army, which itself disbanded formally in 1947, despite some lone soldiers still fighting, unaware that the war had ended. In fact, the last Japanese soldier to surrender did so in December of 1974.
Yeah, it was an episode of The $6 Million Man.
Was it?
Yeah, literally an episode of $6 Million Man did that story.
Of course. But like I mentioned, Mizuki himself wrote and drew the four-volume epic, The History of Japan, the Showa Era, which chronicles, as the title says, the entire history of the Showa Era from December 1926 to January 1989, and also covers the build-up of the war itself, and the after effects. It's great. You know, if you like this, read that as well. A lot of the narrative... is very similar to this, but it's split between history lesson and autobiography. He has a lot more to say in that than he does in this.
Mm-hmm.
Bushido.
No, I was just going to say it's interesting that in this particular story, he eschews all of that completely.
Mm. Probably because he'd said it in that as well.
Yeah, true.
Bushido would continue to become a huge trope throughout Japanese movies and TV throughout the 60s and 70s and be used in multiple ways. The life of Musashi Miyamoto being a huge focal point and an example of that. Akira Kurosawa, a descendant of a samurai family himself, would famously co-write and direct Seven Samurai and then Yojimbo, movies that would subvert that. They would show samurai and ronin be more realistic than other on-screen samurai. There's a famous scene in Seven Samurai where they say, oh, how did you survive that battle? Oh, I hid in a gutter and waited for it to finish. The complete subversion of this sense of Bushido that we see here. You know, it's better to hide and live to fight another battle.
Mm.
A close friend of Kurosawa, Ishiro Honda, would co-create and co-direct one of Japan's biggest exports, Godzilla, who at its very core is a creation and a reminder of the horrors of war and the actions of people. And then further reading, tangentially kind of similar to this and that, Godzilla Minus One, it's on Netflix, you could watch it. That is about the survivor's guilt and the sense that it is better to die than it is to come back, and does great subversions of that post-COVID. And then Grave of the Fireflies as well, which is, in my opinion, is one of the most important and powerful movies about the people of Japan rather than the soldiers of Japan.
Yeah, this was... it was beautiful. This is what you hand to people who think that comics are still kid stuff and not art or literature. It was genuinely powerful and it was genuinely a good read, and I would heartily recommend this to people who don't even normally read this. In fact, to people who don't normally read this kind of thing, read it.
Yeah,
it's genuinely important, and I'd never heard of it before you recommended it for this. Which is criminal.
Well, he's very unheard of. And I think I only knew of him because I think years and years and years ago, when the Showa Era History of Japan stuff was first translated, I think a chapter of it was a free comic book day.
Oh, right.
And I think it was during lockdown when I was going through my big kind of Japan stuff, like Kurosawa and Takeshi Kitano and things like that. It just kind of popped up and I was like, oh, I wouldn't mind reading that. And then I kind of knew of him from that.
Hmm.
And then, yeah, his war stuff was the highlight of those books. So when I saw that there was this as well, that was like, oh, I'm definitely, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah. No, it was an excellent recommendation. Well done. It's we'll be back to, you know, fart gags.
We will.
Next time. We've got an email, so we're not closing it out on a downer note. All right, Michael Bailey emailed in. Andy and Michael, Two Hey Kids in 1 week, and it's not even my birthday. Well, we gave a mini episode.
Yeah.
The Spider-Man number one addendum.
That still counts.
It still counts, yeah. It's still an episode. Just because it's a shorter episode. It's, you know, we still put effort into it.
A little mini.
Yeah.
A little webisode. Are they still a thing, webisodes?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Do you remember them? Yeah. What, did they do webisodes for, like, TV shows and stuff?
Yeah.
Click on the QR code to see a webisode for this episode.
QR codes weren't a thing back then, were they?
It was something like that, wasn't it? Click a link, I don't know. Love the courage of the various Treasury facsimile editions. I feel bad for getting Andy hooked on these things. But he seemed to be enjoying it, so it all comes out in the wash. A few random bits that occurred to me as I was listening into the commentary. I don't remember the issue number, but Spider-Man did take a shot at the Superman vs. Muhammad Ali special. It's been ages since I read this, but my memory is that in the issue where Spider-Man is officially cleared as a suspect in the death of Captain Stacy, a woman who looks awfully like Jeanette Kahn approaches him to do some kind of exhibition fight with boxer Leon Spinks, and Spidey turns her down. I could be wrong on the details, but I was amused by this shot at the competition. No, he's exactly right. It's an issue of Amazing that Marv Wolfman did.
Right.
Keith Pollard drew it, so it's around issue 190-ish. and yeah, Jeanette Kahn literally goes up to Spider-Man and says, you know, we can make a lot of money by putting up against Leon Spinks.
Right.
And Spider-Man's like, no, that's a really dumb idea. But yeah, you're absolutely right though. Well done. Well remembered. Untold Legends wasn't the first miniseries. It was actually World of Krypton, which came out in 1979. I will now return to my rented house at Pedantry Corners. Right, okay, so what was Untold Legends of the Batman the first of then?
I don't know.
Because I'm sure I read somewhere it was the first miniseries. I don't know, maybe it was the first miniseries with a continue, but no, Krypton Superman, isn't it?
I'm also enjoying that back to back I've just seen the bastion of Spider-Man knowledge versus the bastion of Superman knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, fair play. Where does a pedant get his water from? Well, that's a good gag. You laughed at that. Good. That made you chuckle. I should have pushed my specs down me. Thing when I did that. The original story where young Bruce teams up with Harry Harris is even weirder than the retelling. In the story, Bruce is a teenager, but he mentions that everything is happening while his parents are on holiday. This was a thing during the 50s and 60s. When the Waynes died, shifts on the timeline, depending on the stories. Weird that. Well, isn't there that... I'm sure we've had this conversation on an old episode somewhere. How old was Bruce Wayne?
Oh, yeah.
Because depending on what you're reading, he was either 6, 8... 10 or 12. And it entirely depends on what era you're reading. Now, to me, it makes more sense if he's still young, like about 8.
Yeah.
Because if he's 12 and he goes off training to be Batman and he comes back at 21,
yeah,
he's not really had that long
to
get out of school and go and do what he's doing. Whereas if he's only 6 or 8 years of age, he's had time to gestate. And it also fits in more that this, let's be honest, quite childish idea that you can dress up as a vigilante to go and avenge your parents' murder becomes a real thing.
Mm.
It makes more sense to me if he's 6 or 8 years old than 10 or 12. But, I, you know, ultimately it doesn't matter.
No.
Does it? Because it's not real. I had the versions of Untold Legends from the breakfast cereal. It didn't come in the cereal box itself. You had to send off for it. But I love them when they came. It was the summer of 1989 and it came with the god-awful Batman cereal. There was Batman cereal? What does that taste of?
Well, that was still a thing until, I mean, I say recently. Because I remember there was a Shrek 2 cereal. And I nagged you into getting it for me, but it was awful. It was genuinely just so awful.
Yeah, but is the Back to the Future cereals?
Probably, yeah.
That's a terrible idea.
I wonder what Batman cereal tastes
like. Desperation and loneliness.
No, Batman cereal, okay.
Wealth.
Granola with blueberries and dark chocolate.
That's mixture of the darkness and the rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. That's it, gents. Until next time, Mikey might be. Well, thank you for emailing in, Mike and Rob and Rob. You are all very much appreciated. Next time on an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, we're just going back to the well and milking it.
Yeah,
we're going to...
There's a film coming out soon.
There's a film coming out with the Fantastic Four in it, and we're going to do some Fantastic Four stories, some of which I don't think I've heard being covered anywhere before.
Okay.
One of which people don't even seem to know exists.
Okay.
So if you want to read along in preparation for next week, we're doing Fantastic Four Antithesis by Mark Waid and Neil Adams,
mm-hmm.
which, weirdly, given drawn by Neil Adams,
yeah,
it just seems to have disappeared.
Okay.
People are really unaware of that. And it got released as a treasurer,
okay,
which is why we're covering it. We're doing This Man, This Monster, aren't we?
Yes, but only...
As a prelude to Fantastic Four Full Circle, which was Alex Ross's original graphic novel, which came out like last year or the year before?
A couple of years back,
something like that, anyway. So next time we're on from familiar territory, in case, you know, this was a bit too heavy. But Onwards Toward Our Noble Death by Shigeru Mizuki is highly recommended, particularly if you like war comics, and particularly if you like offbeat war comics. Good recommendation. I love that.
Nice one.
Well
Thank
done.
You.
Right, we'll see you all next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production, and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to them. Every single episode of the show going all the way back to the beginning in 2010 is available on archive.org at the address archive.org/details/@APLUK, where you can fill your boots on over 15 years of classic episodes. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/aleyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.